You're listening to episode 11 of the Synchronicity Podcast. Today's text is John chapter 8. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Matt. Our email address is synchronicitypodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at SyncPod. That's SYNCPOD. And if you are still following us on Podomatic, I want to make sure that you know that we do now have our own website. It is synchronicitypodcast.com, SYNCHRONICITYPODCAST.com. We'll probably go another episode or two where we'll post simultaneously on Podomatic and on the website, and then we'll just move over to the site. So readjust your bookmarks and your feeds to the new website. Today we are going to have a look at John chapter 8, and in particular the first part of the chapter, which includes this story about this woman who is caught in adultery and then who is kind of used as a pawn in a game to try to trap Jesus. And we'll get into that story in a minute, but I thought it might be interesting at the outset to talk about the really weird path that this story took before it ended up in your Bible. And to understand how that path developed, you have to understand a little bit about the way these books of the Bible were written and then published. The books in the Bible that tell the stories about Jesus, those are our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. For the most part, we don't think that those books were written by people that were actually present during Jesus' life. Probably most of those people were illiterate. But the people that were present during Jesus' life did form the very earliest and the very first Christian communities. And as those communities began to form and grow, literate people would slowly be drawn into them. And those people, people like Luke, for example, would then take the stories that were being told to them by the people who were present during the life of Jesus, or at least by people who knew about those stories, and they would compile them into the books that we now know as the books of the Bible. And these would just be handwritten painstakingly out on scrolls, jot for jot, letter for letter. Now, when somebody wanted a copy of one of those books, there would not be a local Kinko's that they could run down to and just run one of those copies off. Instead, what they would have to do is they would have to find a scribe, and they would pay the scribe money to kind of go through painstakingly, letter for letter, word for word, and reproduce the entire book. And there were probably even scribes who were members of these very early Christian communities that would do this sort of thing. So what would happen is you would have an original book, and then you would have someone who would make a copy of that book, and that copy would end up probably in a different region, and then another copy would be made, and that copy would end up in a different region, and on the process would go. Now, the interesting thing about this story, about this particular woman that we're going to look at today, is that we really don't think this was a part of the book that was originally put together that we now call the Gospel of John. And the reason is because if you're really smart and if you really want to devote a whole lot of time to it, you can look at these transcripts and you can find little errors, little problems with them. You can try to date them in different ways. You can look at the region where they are found, and you can get a pretty good idea based on all of the different copies of this book that the archaeologists have been able to uncover over time. You can get a pretty good idea about when this copy was written. So we know that some copies, because of where they're found and because of the particular little oddities and small mistakes that are made in them, we know about when they were written and roughly what order that they were written in. And when you order these, what you discover is that the earliest copies of the Gospel of John did not have this story about this woman who was caught in adultery in them. And in fact, if you look in later copies, sometimes you'll find it in the Gospel of John. Sometimes you'll find it over in the Gospel of Luke. It's almost a story without a home. And it's like at some point or another, there was some copyist that was going through this story again, and they get to the beginning of John chapter 8, and they go, you know what? There's a story that we just don't have anywhere, and I just think this story needs to go right here. So he does the equivalent of what you would do with copying and then pasting over into from an old document into a new document. It just kind of sticks this thing right in here in an unusual place. And I actually put a post up on the website where I talked about this issue of, well, does that mean this counts as part of the Bible or not? Because that really is an interesting question. It always has been to me when you have a story that comes from sort of outside what was originally written and pasted in there. Should you really think about that as a part of the canon of Scripture? And in this particular case, it's very, very difficult for me to not think about it as part of the canon of Scripture. This is such a meaningful story. It's a story that deserves to have been told somewhere by somebody. And even if it doesn't really fit in John, even if it's not something that was supposed to be there in the beginning, I'm glad that it didn't somehow get lost in history. I'm glad that at some point somebody decided to go ahead and attach this story to the Gospel of John, because it's well worth telling. Now, before we get into chapter 8 of the Gospel of John, I want to go back and have a look at the book of Deuteronomy. This is a book that was written hundreds of years before the Gospel of John was written, and it was written at a time when, written by people who believed that God had given them a law that they were supposed to follow, and it spells out what God's law is in just a tremendous amount of detail. And this is written at a time when God's people lived out in the desert, and they were wandering about from place to place to place in the desert. So some of it works really well, you know, hundreds of years later, and some of it doesn't really work really well hundreds of years later, and we'll get into that in a little bit in a minute. But part of what this law included was a system of capital punishments, and within that system of capital punishments, it included some safeguards to be sure that the system of capital punishment wasn't implemented unjustly. One of the safeguards you can find in chapter 17 of Deuteronomy, beginning in about verse 2. Here it says, if there is found among you, in one of your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, a man or woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God and transgresses his covenant by going to serve other gods and worshiping them, whether the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven which I have forbidden, and if it is reported to you or you hear of it and you make a thorough inquiry and the charges prove true that such an abhorrent thing has occurred in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has committed this crime, and you shall stone the man or woman to death. Now, hear this. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, the death sentence shall be executed, okay? So you don't just execute the death sentence on some rumor or some hearsay about someone going off and worshiping a foreign god. You have to actually have people who witness this. It says a person must not be put to death on the evidence of only one witness. Again, can you see why here? Maybe you have a neighbor who you don't like very much, and you want to really do them in, so you just lie about something that they've done in order to have the community stone them. This is a way to prevent that, because it means that you're going to have someone else that's going to come in addition to just that one person, who can also witness to this particular act. And then it even goes further. It says the hands of the witnesses shall be the first raised against the person to execute the death penalty, and afterwards the hands of all the other people. And that's how you purge evil from your midst. So there's even another safeguard here. if you're going to be a witness, if you're going to stand up and speak against somebody because they have committed a crime that's worthy of the death penalty, you also have to be the one to throw the first stone, right? You have to be the first one to pick up and cast a stone and cause the first injury, do the first act of condemnation against this person. You can't point fingers and then let someone else do your dirty work. The witnesses have to be the ones who raise their hands and be the first ones to throw the stones. Okay, now, over in chapter 19 and verse 15, also in Deuteronomy, we have it again. A single witness shall not suffice to convict a person of any crime or wrongdoing in connection with any offense that may be committed. Only on the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a charge be sustained. And then it goes on, if a malicious witness does come forward to accuse someone of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute appear before the Lord and before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. And the judges shall make a thorough inquiry. And if it's discovered that the witness is a false witness, having testified falsely against the other, then you do to the false witness just as the false witness had meant to do to the other. So, it says again, you shall purge the evil from your midst. Fascinating to me to see how even hundreds upon hundreds of years ago, there are laws, there are rules in place that are intended to prevent people from being falsely accused, falsely convicted of crimes, and in particular, falsely convicted of capital crimes. Now, one of the capital crimes that was in place under this old law was the capital crime of adultery. And there's some discussion about that in the book of Deuteronomy as well. It's in verse 22 of chapter 22. That's where the discussion begins. And it says this: if a man is caught lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman as well as the woman. So you shall purge the evil from Israel. That's kind of a mantra in Deuteronomy. This is how you purge evil from Israel. Now, notice something from this verse right away. If a man is caught lying with the wife of another man, primarily adultery in the book of Deuteronomy is a crime that one man commits against another man. Now, the wife that is involved in the act of adultery, she may also be punished during this process, but the focus of the crime is on what the man who is committing adultery with someone else's wife is doing to that other person. Now, something else that's interesting that follows that won't be directly applicable to John chapter 8, but I think is worth looking at, is what is said in verse 23 following this. Deuteronomy 22, chapter 22, verse 23. If there is a young woman, a virgin already engaged to be married, and a man meets her in the town and lies with her, you shall bring both of them to the gate of that town and stone them to death. The young woman, because she did not cry for help in the town, and the man, because he violated the neighbor's wife. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. But, it goes on to say, if the man meets the engaged woman in the open country, and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man, you hear this? Only the man who lay with her shall die. You shall do nothing to the young woman. The young woman has not committed an offense punishable by death, because this case is like that of someone who attacks and murders a neighbor. Since he found her in the open country, the engaged woman may have cried for help, but there was no one to rescue her. So you hear here some protections again in favor of the woman who participates or is allegedly has participated in the act of adultery. Or in this case, the act of fornication. If there's a young woman, a virgin already, and she's engaged to be married, and in town someone meets with them and she doesn't cry out for help, then she is punished. But there is a presumption if she cries out for help that she should not be punished because she was not acting voluntarily in the process. Then we also see how if something happens where in the open country a man seizes a woman and lies with her, she There's no way that she can ever face the death penalty for that situation, because it's possible that she cried out for help and there was no one to help her. So, we see when we talk about adultery that it's primarily a crime that is committed by a man against a man in Deuteronomy. But there's also some presumptions that seem to follow. The law seems to favor the possibility that the woman was not voluntarily participating in the relationship at the time. Okay, now, John chapter 8. John chapter 8 and verse 2. Early in the morning, he, Jesus, came again to the temple. Remember, in chapter 7 we talked about last week, Jesus has been in Jerusalem. He's been teaching in the temple. He's been agitating the spiritual leaders there. Early in the morning, he comes again to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down, and he began to teach them. So here, Jesus, this rabbi with rising popularity, sitting in the temple, teaching, kind of flaunting the authority of the people who claim to be in charge there. And so along come these people, the scribes and the Pharisees, it says. They brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery." Now, in the law, remember Deuteronomy, we just read that, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say? Now, there are all kinds of issues that kind of pop up just in these first few verses here. So let's kind of take them one at a time here. First of all, I find it interesting to see that the scribes and the Pharisees know what Jesus will want to do. He'll want to let her off the hook. He won't want to see her stoned. They know they're putting her in a very difficult, or they're trying at least, to put him in a very, very difficult position by challenging him in this way. The idea here of this challenge is, well, Jesus is going to have to choose. He's either going to have to be consistent with himself and show grace and mercy and forgiveness as he does to other people, to this woman as well, or he's going to have to choose the law of Moses, which the crowd would presumably respect, and he's going to have to indicate that he's against the law of Moses. So they're trying to put him between a rock and a hard place. He can either say he wants to be graceful and merciful toward this woman, in which case he's against the law of Moses, or he can say he favors the law of Moses, in which case a lot of his character that has caused him to become so popular is going to be called into question by the crowds. But there's also something very, very fishy that's going on here. If you paid any attention to what happened back in, or what we talked about back in Deuteronomy a moment ago. Number one, if Jesus is supposed to be deciding this case, fine, where are the witnesses? Remember, the bare allegation that this woman was caught in some kind of an act of adultery is not enough to cause her to be stoned. We need not just one witness, but two witnesses to this act. And then, once we have those two witnesses, if they're judged to be credible witnesses, then those two should be the ones that pick up the stones and are the first ones to cast the stones. Now, that's important, so keep that in mind as we move through the story. So that's the first problem. That's the first fishy thing that's going on here, is we don't have any witnesses to this alleged crime. But there's another problem here, which is, where is the guy? Where is the man who is supposed to be the principal perpetrator of this crime? Remember, adultery, as it's viewed in Deuteronomy, is a crime that a man commits against a man. So where is the man? Well, these are both clues that the people that are confronting Jesus here aren't really concerned about adultery. In fact, if they were concerned about the issue of adultery, and if they really did have the evidence, then this woman would already be dead. The truth of the matter is that they are using her. And it's easy to use her because she's done something that's very, very easy to shame, and she's going to be a very, very powerless person within this particular community. Now, I want to make an observation here. Spiritual communities will often single out sexual sins, and particularly the sexual sins of people that are powerless, in this case, women, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, and turn the people that commit those sins into kind of scapegoats that divert attention from all of the other problems and all of the other sins that are in the community. So at a church, you may have a situation where there is greed, there is gossip, there is this resistance and reluctance to welcome the poor, all kinds of things that are contrary to the teachings of the Bible and the teachings of Jesus. And sometimes when you have a church that has all of those kinds of problems, when they get a whiff of a sexual sin that's going on anywhere of any nature, they tend to come down very, very hard on it. And when you see that, that is a sign of illness within a spiritual community. And the question you need to be asking yourself when you just see a lot of focus and a lot of desire to come down on something like that is, what else is going on in this community that it is so obsessed with sin of this nature? And the things that Jesus is going to do throughout the rest of this story are really going to be kind of designed to unmask that, to reveal that that's what's going on here. There's a great obsession with this, and there are all kinds of other things that that are being ignored here. So, how does Jesus respond? Well, he responds by bending down and writing with his finger on the ground. Now, what is all of this about? Some people think that they may have an idea about what he was writing here, because there's a text back in the Old Testament that talks about how God is going to write down people's sins. And so they think maybe what he's doing is he's writing out all of the things: greed, gluttony, you know, gossip, the things that these people are guilty of. He's writing those in the dirt. I don't know if that's what he's doing. What he's almost certainly doing here is refusing to recognize the authority of the people that are posing this question. They don't have the ability to compel an answer from him, and he's trying to show that to them by the way he is behaving here. He's almost certainly doing that, if he's not doing more than that. But they keep pestering him, see? They keep questioning him. What do we do with this woman? She was caught committing adultery. Tell us what to do. And so what Jesus does is he stands up and he addresses what I think is the obvious problem here. The problem we have, as we talked about a moment ago, is we have no witnesses. And without witnesses, we don't have people to throw the first two stones at this woman to condemn her. So now what are we going to do? Who is going to be the first one to cast the stones? That's the magic question now. So Jesus turns to them and says, well, let's just do it this way then. Let the person who is without sin, let that person throw the first stones. And now we have a problem, because no one who's making these accusations is going to claim to be without any kind of sin whatsoever. So it says, beginning with the elders, and then for the rest of them, they all go away one by one. And now we get to a statement in this text that I really think it's the most striking, most beautiful statement here. I know that the statement he makes before, "Let the one without sin cast the first stone," that's become almost iconic of Jesus in a lot of ways. And it's the one that a lot of people walk away and remember. But to me, the most beautiful thing that he says in this text is the next thing that he says, which is, "Woman, where are they? Is there no one left to condemn you?" And she says in response, "No one, sir. There's no one here that's condemning me." And he says, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, don't sin again." This is what makes this story so beautiful to me. Because this is what Jesus does. This is just a beautiful insight into the heart of Jesus. It's not that he doesn't judge. It's not that he doesn't make a determination as to whether somebody has committed a wrong or a sin or not. He does that. He understands that. He's not somebody who looks the other way. But Jesus isn't somebody who judges and then condemns. He is instead somebody who judges and then sets free. Do you understand what this text is giving us in terms of insight into Jesus? He's a judge, yes, just as he's been seen here, but he is a judge that sets people free after he decides the case. Skip down just a few more verses, because I think there's a reason why somebody decided this story needs to go in the beginning of John chapter 8. We're moving back in now into some things that were in this book, this Gospel of John, originally. In verse 31, Jesus says to the people that believe in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Now, there are a lot of colleges and universities that kind of take this saying, "You'll know the truth and the truth will set you free," and kind of put it over doors and on letterheads and in all kinds of other places, because they like the idea that education sets someone free. And I think there's some truth to that maxim. But I don't think that's what Jesus is saying here. I think what he is saying is that if you follow my words, if you walk in my footstep, you'll come to know me. You'll come to believe in me, and that is the thing. I am the thing that will set you free. And then there's a response to what he says here. He says, they answered him, "We're descendants of Abraham and have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying you will be free?" And Jesus answers, "Very true, I tell you, everyone who commits a sin is a slave to sin." Do you hear that? You've sinned, and therefore you're a slave to it. You are condemned by it in that particular way. The slave, Jesus says, does not have a permanent place in the household. The son has a place there forever. So, if the son makes you free, you will be free indeed. Do you hear that? If the son makes you free, you will be free indeed. Jesus, the son, the judge, sets people free. That's the thing that he does. And then one other interesting thing to me is the end of chapter 8. Jesus does a lot of other things that antagonize the spiritual leaders in his community during this chapter. And we see at the very end that these leaders have picked up stones to throw at Jesus, and Jesus has to hide himself and go out of the temple when they pick up those stones against Jesus. The chapter started with Jesus being confronted by people who wanted to stone a woman, and the chapter ends as it's been modified now over time, with people wanting to stone Jesus. Again, this is what this book, these people that put this together, these people that years later went in and added some things to this book, this is what they want us to know that Jesus does. Just like the boats that come between the whalers and the whales, he stands between our accusers and the people that are weak. He stands between the accusers and the people who are weak, the people who are guilty, the people who are in need of condemnation, and he invites their wrath, their punishment, on himself. What strikes me about this chapter is that we all kind of have choices similar to the ones that Jesus had here. When we encounter vulnerable people, whether they're vulnerable because of the place they have in society or because of what they've done or because of the way people perceive them, we have a choice. It's easy to judge them, but our real choice is, are we going to condemn them or are we going to set them free? You know, it feels good sometimes to condemn somebody, to point the finger at them, because it makes our own vulnerabilities and our own shortcomings kind of fade away, at least for a moment. But they don't ever go away forever. They're always still kind of somewhere lurking in the background, haunting us, no matter how much time we spend yelling and screaming about what somebody else is doing. But I think there's some real joy to be found in living this way. The message of the Bible and the message of John, particularly in this chapter, really is this, that the universe is coming under new rules, that God is no longer in the condemning business, and that we should likewise not be in the condemning business any longer. And when you act like Jesus did in this story and work to set people free from the condemnation that they face from those people that are around them, whether it's standing between them and the people that would condemn them, or whether it's picking them up and trying to encourage them and cheer them on in life in spite of the disadvantages that they might have. When you do this act, I think there's a lot of joy to be found. And I really do think that it's only when we do these kinds of things that we really find the joy of realizing that we too have been set free, that we're no longer operating under this system where we are judged and then condemned and then tossed out. Well, thanks again to Q Music and Peace Love Production for the bumper music that we use in the podcast. Invite you to go over to iTunes and give us a review, give us a rating. That really helps us to grow in our popularity. And as always, if you have a comment or a question that you want to email, either in text form or audio form, you can do that at synchronicity.podcast@gmail.com. We might even play your comment or question on the air. Well, that'll wrap it up for today. Next time, we will move into John chapter 9.